Arche in Greek means to govern, and so mono means like one, like mono and versus stereo, right? So monarchy means the government of one, the rule of one. And when there's a rule of a group, it's called oligarchy. You've heard of oligarchy, it means the rule of a group. And when no one is in charge, it's just no one is governing, it's called anarchy. In other words, no arche, no govern, no one governing, and so on. So there are different types of kings. I mean, they're different. There are different. It's not enough to say, okay, in this country, a king rules. Because if you look at history, even in Europe or the West, there were different types of monarchies. For example, at times there are what is called absolute monarchy. Absolute monarchy, and this is not what they had in India, and this is the point I wanted to make. Absolute monarchy means the king can do whatever he wants. There are no laws, there's no justice. You can't say to a king, wait a second, you can't do that because it's against the law. You know, in absolute monarchy, if you say that, the king will just take your head off, like off with the queen. You know, like Alice in Wonderland, off with their heads, off with their heads. And actually, that line in Alice in Wonderland was sort of a satire on these sort of like these absolute monarchs, you know, that just say off with their heads. So in ancient Vedic India, it was not absolute monarchy. There were laws. There was a constitution, and the Sanskrit word for law is dharma. If you wanted to say law in Sanskrit, it would be dharma. And so the king himself had to follow laws, had to follow dharma. Oh, dharma, M as in Matilda. So, dharma means the law. In fact, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 4, that yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata, whenever dharma is collapsing, and adharma, which means injustice, and lawlessness is rising, then Krishna says, I come. So the Kurus, headed by, of course, Duryodhana, the so-called king was Dhritarashtra, but he was weak. He was weak in the sense he was too attached to his son, and therefore he could not act according to fair principles. I mean, imagine if you went to court, and let's say someone had acted unfairly to you, or cheated you, or robbed you, or injured you, and the person you were accusing is the son of the judge. And the judge says, well, I think my son is innocent. All the evidence is against the person you're accusing. All the evidence is against this person, but the judge says, well, that's my boy, so he can go free. I mean, obviously, you can't run a country like this. And that's what was going on in ancient India. So, in fact, it wasn't... Another point that's made again and again in the Mahabharata is that the kingdom, the Kuru kingdom, was, the way they say it in Sanskrit, it was for Yudhisthira, Pitarpaitamaha Raja. It was the kingdom of his father and forefathers. It was his rightful inheritance. The Pandavas, of course, they were very fortunate because they were friends of Krishna, but they also suffered a lot of tragedy. They lost their father. And their father left them an inheritance. And that inheritance was the kingdom. And so if someone's father passes away and he leaves his estate or his fortune to his children, and someone comes and steals the family property, it's not okay. So that's what happened. Therefore, Krishna encouraged Arjuna to fight because what was at stake there was the rule of law. In other words, are there going to be objective laws, fair laws that everyone has to follow? You know, everyone has to follow the same rules of the game, or is it that some people don't have to play by the rules? Some people can cheat. And so if you're just playing a game like, I don't know, people, you know, what, soccer, or whatever you play. You know, if you're playing some game and the other side is cheating, or let's say the referee likes the other team better than your team and so is cheating for the other team, you can't play a game like that. And now, so if that's frustrating when you're playing a game, imagine if a country is being run like that. So that, for example, Duryodhana tried in many ways to assassinate the Pandavas. He tried to kill them. And yet there was no question of them, you know, being brought to justice. There was no justice. And so what was at stake? So it comes down to, is the country going to be governed by law so that there's justice and fairness? Or is the country going to be governed simply by the lust and greed of some out-of-control person? So in a sense, it was civilization that was at stake. It was a civilization that was at stake. There's another point also, and that is the Mahabharata actually takes place on three different levels, which are earthly, cosmic, and transcendental. I'll explain that. When you read the Mahabharata, on the one hand, you can understand that, okay, this is part of the history of this planet, that thousands of years ago in ancient India, there were these different royal families like Kurus and Panchalas and, of course, the Pandavas and so on. And there was cheating and injustice, and it came to war. So you can understand Mahabharata as simply a political history of the ancient world. However, it so happens that the Kurus and Pandavas weren't really the Kurus and Pandavas. They were actually demigods. In other words, the story of the Mahabharata actually begins in the 8th canto of the Bhagavatam. Because in the 8th canto of the Bhagavatam, the asuras and asuras, the gods and the demons, are churning the ocean of milk to come up with, you know, all hundreds of different flavors of ice cream and so on. Low-fat yogurt. But actually, they were churning the ocean of milk. They were churning the ocean of milk. And, you know, Lakshmi came out, and Uchaitshrava, the celestial horse, and all kinds of amazing cosmic things were coming out of the ocean. And then finally the pot of nectar. Whoever drank that nectar would live, you know, almost forever. You never live forever in this world, but could live a very long time. So Krishna came, incarnated as Mohini Murti, and gave that nectar to the gods, because he knew they will use this power to help people, and the demons will use it to enslave people. So therefore, Vishnu gave that nectar to the gods. The demons didn't like that at all, and they basically went crazy. Come in. And so a big war broke out. And this is like a great summer blockbuster movie. You know, it's like this, you need like supercomputer graphics to do this movie. But anyway, they had this big cosmic battle between the gods and the demons, and the demons started to win. So at that point, the demigods, they prayed to Vishnu, and Vishnu came, riding on Garuda, the super eagle. Actually, the word Garuda means eagle. So when Vishnu appeared, now the demons could have been humble about this, and they could have said, okay, Vishnu, there's some way that we could please you, that we could also get, you know, maybe a six-pack of this nectar. But the demons, they didn't do that. So Kalanami, there was this one really bad demon. I mean, he definitely had an attitude. There was this demon named Kalanami. K-A-L-A-N-E-M-I, Kalanami. And as soon as Vishnu appeared, he took this trident, and these are cosmic weapons. These are not like ordinary earth weapons. He took this celestial trident, and actually trident tridanta in Sanskrit. It has like three teeth, three knives on it. He took this trident and he threw it at Garuda. He wanted to kill Garuda. So, in other words, he didn't want to negotiate. So Vishnu caught the trident in his hand and killed Kalanami with his own weapon. And then there were other demons like Viprachitti, who was another general of the demons. Anyway, what happened is when the demons lost, they came up with a strategy. And the strategy is, let's go find... How many of you have seen Star Wars? No? The Death Star? So, the strategy the demons came up with is, let's go to some remote part of the universe where no one will suspect us. Like, you know, just get away from things. Let's take over some small planet that no one cares about. And then once we take over that planet, we can use it as a base from which to attack and take over the universe. So the sort of small, out of the way, wrong side of the cosmic tracks planet they chose, the planet they chose was the Earth. So in the 10th canto, when the story begins, once the world was overburdened, in the Krishna book, once the earth was overburdened by the military forces of demons disguised as kings, that should be taken literally. In other words, they actually were not from Earth. The reason, you know the story? They know the story? The Bhumi went to Brahma?
Not yet.
Oh. Anyway, so Bhumi, the goddess of the earth, she had to go to Brahma because these demons from higher planets were taking over the earth. They were taking birth in royal families and becoming kings of different countries. So the demons were actually taking over the earth. And that's why Krishna came. So again, you can look at Mahabharata. It's a story of, it's a political history of the ancient world, especially ancient South Asia, which we now call, well, actually India, Pakistan, Afghanistan. I mean, for example, Gandhari, who was the wife of Dhritarashtra, she was from Afghanistan. She's called Gandhari, and Gandhari today is called Kandahar. It's in Afghanistan, if you read the news. So therefore, it's not only an earthly battle, it's a political history of the universe. Because they're fighting for the earth, but they're also fighting for the universe. It's like, for example, let's say if you study something like World War II, and there's a battle going on somewhere in wherever, you know, France or Germany or this or that. They're not only fighting for that little small piece of land that's the battlefield, they're fighting for countries. The battle just happens to take place on a relatively small battlefield. And so the battlefield was the earth, but actually they were fighting for the universe. And finally, the third level of Mahabharata is, it's a story about God and about what's beyond the universe. Because Krishna came and spoke Bhagavad Gita. So ultimately, the Mahabharata is talking about what is beyond the universe. So it's talking about the earth, the universe, and what is beyond the universe. And so all these things are going on at the same time in the Mahabharata. Anyway, so Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita tells Arjuna to fight because the universe has, the earth has been taken over. These demons want to enslave the universe and destroy Dharma, destroy justice. And so there's something at stake. In other words, they're trying to take over the universal government. I mean, what if in America or some other country, you know, some terrorist or something go to Washington and try to take over the government? We would expect that the military would not let them do that. It's not that if someone, terrorists go and they want to take over the government and enslave us, and all the military says, well, we want to be nice, so we won't fight. We'll let them take over the country. No, that's not what they're supposed to do. In that sense, Krishna was shocked, like Arjuna, what are you doing? Don't you understand what's at stake here? Don't you understand what's going on? So that's why Krishna is urging Arjuna to fight. There's the whole universe is at stake. Not to speak of the earth. So, any questions on these points?
So
yes?
Mahabharata is pretty much like universe world one. Almost,
like what?
Almost like universe world one.
Yeah, exactly. Very good point. Yeah, there's World War One and Universe War One. Actually, it's not number one, though, because there were, if you read the Bhagavatam, they've been at this for some time. But yeah, it was a cosmic battle. It's just the battleground was the Earth. But actually, it was a universal battle. I forgot to tell you, Kalanemi, that guy that threw the trident at Garuda and tried to kill him and Vishnu, he came to Earth, and did anyone know? Of the young people. Does anyone know how he took birth, who he was at his name when he took birth on earth? He became Kamsa. That's who Kamsa is. Good old Uncle Kamsa. And Viprachitti, who was another general, he took birth as Jarasandha, that you'll learn about. So therefore I say the Mahabharata story really begins in the 8th canto of the Bhagavatam with that cosmic battle. And that's why Narada Muni comes in the Bhagavatam, comes to Kamsa and tells him, in your last life, Vishnu killed you. And he'll probably do it again. So that killing of Kamsa in his last life is described in the eighth canto of the Bhagavatam. It's Kalanamy. In fact, the Bhagavatam even, Kamsa is even told, you were Kalanamy. So it actually, the Mahabharata story begins with the churning of the ocean of milk. Shirodaka. What do they say in India now? Kheer? Milk? From the Sanskrit. What?
Sweet rice.
Yeah, but the Sanskrit word is kshira. Kshira, that means milk. And then uda. Udaka is water. Actually, we still have the word udaka in English in the form of that popular beverage, vodka. Of course, devotees don't drink vodka. Please tell me you don't drink vodka. So anyway, vodka is a Russian word meaning water. And the word vodka is Sanskrit udaka, like kshirodaka shayi vishnu. So everything comes from Vedic culture, even vodka.
One of the points that was mentioned last week that the students were a little bit baffled,
yes,
were the unfairness, the hypocrisy that they heard in the Mahabharata, especially when it comes to Draupadi's being disrobed in the assembly,
yes,
of so many people, and her own husband and family member didn't do anything.
Yes.
So,
okay, we can talk about that. Yeah. She definitely had a bad day at the office. A bad day at the gambling hall. So, first of all, you have to keep in mind what the situation was. The situation was that the Pandavas had no weapons and they were surrounded by thousands of enemies that had all kinds of weapons. So, I mean, imagine, have any of you ever seen like modern movies? Never seen a modern movie?
Yeah,
you have seen a modern action films, shoot 'em ups, as they call it.
I've seen a lot of James Bond.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. Okay. Yeah, we need Sadhguru to be Agent 108. Agent 108. Anyway, so imagine if James Bond or something, you know, he's a big hero and he gets the bad guys. Imagine if he's trapped, he's in a room, and he's surrounded by like 1,000 bad guys, they all have machine guns. I mean, what's he going to do? He's not just going to go into his Taekwondo moves or something. And so the Pandavas were, I mean, they couldn't do anything because they were surrounded. And don't forget, the Pandavas had supernatural powers, but so did the demons. The demons also had supernatural powers, and they had all their weapons. Another point is that you would misunderstand it if you thought that Yudhisthira actually gambled away his brothers or himself. Because in order to understand what that meant, it's not because people were not just property. Like, okay, I'll put down a Bhima and an Arjuna and, I don't know, you know, and two palaces. So people aren't just property. In order to understand what he was doing, you have to understand the nature of law in feudal societies. Okay. Anyone here know what feudal societies are? Okay, since everyone understands that. What I mean to say is, once there was like people started, say, inventing machines and factories, and everyone started moving in cities to work in factories, the world changed very greatly. So the world we live in now, with cars and buildings, and I mean, you know, these big cities and everything, it's very different than the world used to be. So the way the world used to be, including the world of the Mahabharata, is that the way people understood life is that God is at the top of everything. And under God is, so to speak, a pyramid. You know, so like at the top, there's not so many people, and at the bottom, there's like massive people. But everything is a hierarchy. That means everything is, you know, like, so every citizen, every person in a country has to serve someone. Everyone has an obligation to serve. So the Pandavas, for example, by Dharma, by sacred law, the Pandavas, the four younger brothers, they had to serve Yudhisthira because he was the older brother. So that service, that obligation to serve, was something that you could buy and sell, so to speak. I mean, it's just like, for example, let's say you own a company and you have 10 people working for you in your company. And let's say someone buys your company, then the 10 people working for you are then working for the new owner, assuming they want to keep their job. And usually people do want to keep their job. So therefore, when you buy a company, you're not buying the people, but you can buy the contracts. Like let's say if someone signs a contract, I will work for you for 1 year and you pay me this much money. That's a contract. So someone can buy that contract. So in a sense, there were contracts where people had to serve, like an older brother served the king. And so he was sort of, so to speak, gambling that obligation. You understand? So not gambling the people. Another thing is that, the Pandavas, they had no power. They had no weapons. You could say, well, Bhishma is so strong, couldn't he just smash 1,000 super powerful demons, all of whom have all these weapons? Yeah, you can do that in comic books, but not in the real world. So there's really nothing they could do. One thing I can say about the Pandavas, though, if you read the Mahabharata, up until the insult to Draupadi, the Pandavas would always tolerate, because the Pandavas actually didn't grow up as warriors. The Pandavas actually grew up as brahmanas, because their father lived high up in the Himalaya in a place called Shatashringa, which means 100 peaks. Could you tell them to keep that down? Someone's talking there. Right here. Oh, there. The phone. Maybe just keep it down a little bit. Oh. So what was I just saying? Yes. So Pandu, their father, Pandu, the great king, he went high up into the mountains and became a yogi. So the Pandavas actually grew up as yogis. They didn't grow up as warriors. They grew up as yogis. And therefore, when their father died, they were brought back. Their uncle, Dhritarashtra, was afraid that they might take over the kingdom that belonged to them. So their uncle brought them back so he could watch them and control them. So imagine what it was like for these boys. They were just young boys. They lost their father, and two of them lost their mother as well. And at the age of, maybe they were like, about your age. I mean, how old are all of you? How old are you? 10 and a half. And you? 12?
Almost 15. 11. Almost 13.
Okay. Very good. The Pandavas were almost exactly your ages. Because there's five Pandavas. And so Yudhisthira's first, and then Arjun's a year, Bhima's a year younger, Arjun's a year younger, and the two twins are also another year younger. So they were just about your age, say between 10 and 13 or 14.
But we see depictions that are like, big, muscular...
Hare Krishna. What the Bhagavatam says actually is they were aprapta jovana, which means they hadn't reached puberty. In other words, they were actually still children. So they were maybe like 9, 10, 11, something like that. And that's what the Bhagavatam says, and that's also what the Mahabharata says. I mean, with all due respect to creative art. So the Pandavas were just these young people and who grew up as yogis. So when they came, the people were shocked. Because when they first came down to the mountains, everyone was saying, are those really the Pandavas? Because everyone knew these are the great princes. These are the great Kuru princes. But they were dressed in deerskin like yogis. And they had, the matted locks. They were just like these little child yogis. And people were saying, are those the Pandavas? So imagine being 9, 10, 11 years old, and for the first time in your life, you see a horse. Or an elephant. Or a city. They'd never seen these things. They were like maybe 10, 11,000 feet up in the mountains. There's no horses up there. There's no elephants. There's no cities. There's no armies. They had never seen a city in their life. They were just these young boys. And so they first of all, they're suffering. Their father suddenly died. and Madri, the, you know, one of the mothers, also died. So they're already shocked and traumatized by that. And suddenly they come down from them, even to see them, coming down from the highest mountains in the world, just coming down in this funeral procession, down to the great imperial capital of the world, Hastinapur. And so, and as they're coming down, like the lower and lower elevations, as they're coming down the mountains, they start to see little towns and villages. And then undoubtedly, if you just know the topography of India, as they're coming down from the mountains, at a certain point, they can see maybe like 30, 40 miles away, 50 miles away, the great imperial capital with these domes, as you described, these shining domes of gold and silver and copper. Just like these boys, they're just yogis. All they knew was living up in the mountains, snow, ice. Oh my God. So they're coming down the mountain like this, and then at a certain point they see, like, at least 56, because in those days, actually the sky was much cleaner. They didn't have factories, they didn't have cars. And even airline pilots say that, for example, it used to be that in America, let's say if you took off from San Francisco, when you were just up in the air for about 5 or 10 minutes, you could practically see Los Angeles 300 miles away. So the air was very different. The air was, I mean, you could see 3-4 times as far as you can see now. And so the Pandas would have seen 50, 60, 70, even 100 miles away, like these glittering domes and palaces. And they'd never seen a city before. And so they come down to Hastinapur, and they're just like, imagine, their jaw drops, and they're just like wide-eyed, and they've never seen anything like this before. Horses, elephants, armies, buildings, people rushing around. And then they're there just a very short time, and their uncle Vidura comes to them and says, oh, by the way, the king is trying to kill you. And so the Pandavas, they were just these innocent boys. Again, they grew up as yogis, where you tolerate everything and austerities and your, you know, ahimsa, nonviolence. And so that's why they kept tolerating, no matter what was done, because they were just these little yogis. But then, when the Kurus insulted Draupadi, that's when everything changed. That was, as they say, the game changer. When the Kurus insulted Draupadi, that's when the Pandavas said, it's finished. Now it's war. Now we're going to kill you. And so not only were women not taken care of, again, not only were women not, let's say, disregarded, oh, she's just a woman, don't worry about her. I mean, it wasn't like that at all. Actually, for themselves, the Pandavas tolerated everything. But when Draupadi was insulted, they said, now we're going to kill you because you insulted a woman. So they were, that's the way the culture was. Yes?
But you said they were like 10, 11, 12, but they were already married to Draupadi.
No. Oh, this is much later. This is a gambling match.
Oh.
I'm saying from the time they came down into Hastinapur till then, they just tolerated. I mean, they were being insulted and cheated and assassination plots, and they just kept tolerating. But when Draupadi was insulted, that was the end. Then they said, they actually announced in a public assembly, we're going to kill you. And they did. Of course, they gave the Kurus many chances to, in fact, Krishna, the Bhagavatam says that as soon as the Kurus just touched Draupadi's hair, because Draupadi wasn't even a human, Draupadi was actually a goddess. She was born out of a fire sacrifice. There was a great fire sacrifice with an altar, and she just came out of the fire altar. So she wasn't even human, she was a goddess. And the Bhagavatam says that just by touching her hair, just because they dared to touch her hair, they sealed their death warrant. And Draupadi herself cursed them. She said, Draupadi, and these women were extremely powerful, very powerful women. When they insult her like that, Draupadi said, you have insulted me by loosening my hair, and so all of your wives will loosen their hair, because when the woman becomes a widow and her husband dies and she lets down her hair in mourning. And so Draupadi said, your wives are going to loosen their hair when they all become widows. And Krishna heard that curse from Draupadi and he said, I will enforce it. So it's a great story.
Anything?
Durasanda, who was he before?
Vipra, V-I-P-R-A, Chitti, C-I-T-T-I. Yes?
In which, the Mahabharata actually begins in the 8th canto of...
Bhagavatam. You know what the word Jarasandha means? Jara means old age. And that's where we get English words like geriatric or gerontology and so on, like, you know, like dealing with old age. And so Jara is, she was a witch. I guess she must have been what we call a hag, like she was this old witch. And Sanda, sun, means together, which we still have in English also, like Sankirtan. And we still have in English, but in English we use the Greek spelling, which is S-Y-N, like synthesis, or symbiotic, which means together. Anyway, and ta means to put. So to put together by Jara. What happened is that Jarasandha's parents, his father, the king, and his wife, the queen, they couldn't beget children. They were very frustrated. And so a great sage gave them a blessing. He gave them like some magic mango and said, if you eat this, then you know, she'll become pregnant. So Jarasandha's mother ate that and she became pregnant and everyone was ecstatic. And when the child was born, it was born in two halves. It was like a completely symmetrical two halves. Like each half of the body had one eye, one nostril, half a mouth, and you know, and on down. You know, one foot, and it was just like these perfect symmetrical halves. And she just thought, yuck. So it was what they call the yuck factor. Anyway, she got grossed out by this, and she just thought, oh my God, this is like a monstrosity. So she just like tossed it. She put it in her, I guess, the royal dumpster. I mean, she gave these two parts to one of her nurses. It's like, throw this out in the forest. She was just like, totally, ah. But what happened is, a witch came along, a witch named Jara. And she saw these two halves of the child. And, you know, witches, they kind of like magic and sort of weird things. And so she liked it, you know, kind of appealed to her. Like, this is weird, I like it. So she took the two halves of the baby. She took the two halves of the baby, just put them together, like, let's see what this does. And then, boom, suddenly it came alive. The two halves just, they came together, and it became a living baby. And she understood, because, you know, because she watched the news on TV. She understood this was actually the king's son, or, you know, whatever the equivalent was back then. And so she took this little baby back to the royal palace and said, I think you lost this. And then they realized that the sage had really given a true blessing. And so therefore, because she put the two pieces together, he was called Jarasandha, literally put together by Jara. By the way, everyone knew this, and that's why when much, much later in the story when, because Jarasandha was really sort of a monstrous kind of guy. He would like kidnap other kings that had wives and children and just like butcher them in front of the goddess because he, you know, kind of, you know, he was kind of gothic. Anyway, so Jarasandha was really this monstrous person. He was a demon. And so Krishna and Arjuna and Bhima went to kill him and Bhima fought with him and it was like a real battle because Jarasandha was very strong. He was from higher planets. Like Bhima. And so then Krishna gave Bhima a hint. He took a little twig, like in a fork, you know, and he pulled it apart. In other words, he was Jarasandha. He can also be taken apart the way he was put together. And that's what eventually Bhima did. In the wrestling match, they were fighting, you know, match to the death. And Bhima got him down on the ground, put one foot on one of his legs, and then took his other foot in his hand and just ripped him apart. Just as he'd been put back together. He was, so it's quite a story. Better than Middle Earth. Any other questions?
And one last point. That's yes. From Bhima, right? Because
yes.
We like to relate current events in our class.
Yes, absolutely.
We are entering the period of politics, elections.
Oh,
you do
yes.
Mention that in the Mahabharata there was some kind of democracy.
There was constitutional monarchy.
So that the freedom
in other words, yeah, that's another really interesting thing. That it's not like the idea you have of monarchy, where if you say one wrong word, the king will throw you in a dungeon and torture you or something. It's not like that. For example, in the Mahabharata, when Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana sent the Pandavas to a city called Varnavata, with the house of lack, they built this house to be a fire trap because they wanted to burn the Pandavas alive. And the house did burn down, but the Pandavas escaped through a tunnel because Vidura saved them and sent an engineer there to dig a tunnel. So, but all the people thought the Pandavas were dead. Everyone thought the Pandavas were dead. And the people were furious and heartbroken because everyone loved the Pandavas. So they all just went out into the middle of the city and started insulting, criticizing the king because they knew this was no accident. They couldn't prove it. First of all, they couldn't prove it because they couldn't get close to it because the government would keep you away. But everyone knew. And you have scenes like that other places in the Bhagavatam, Mahabharata, where people criticize the government, criticize the king, and there's no punishment. You're allowed to do that. There's freedom of speech. How does Duryodhana respond, or Dhritarashtra, how does he respond when he hears the people are insulting them? They say, well, we need a public relations campaign. We got to fix up our image here. You know, let's go kiss some babies or open some hospitals or something. So, but it's understood that there's freedom. And actually, if you look at the history of India, the oldest history of Vedic India, people had freedom of religion. They had freedom of speech. It was a very advanced civilization. And it was a constitutional monarchy, which meant the government, the king, had to follow the law. And there was justice. Yes?
I'm just wondering, when the Lord descends to the material world and he sees that Duryodhana saw Krishna and the Pandavas saw Krishna.
Yes.
But we understand Krishna is to be all attractive, that he is completely, whoever sees him, you know, develops affection. I was wondering, why does the demons then...
Well, because Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Naham Prakasha Sarvasya, I'm not revealed to everyone. Yoga Maya Samabrata. Krishna's right here now. Krishna's in this room as much as he was in Dwarka or Vrindavan. Krishna's right in this room. Why don't we see him? Because we still have impurities covering us. But Krishna's right here. So in the same way, even though Krishna was... For example, the deity's right there. The deity is right here in the temple. That's Krishna. So why do some people come and they look at the temple and they think, oh, that's nice, are those your idols or something? You know, they don't get it. They don't get it. But that is Krishna. When we go to the temple, we see, oh, it's Krishna. He's there. So just as some people can see the deity is there and some people can't see it, some people still think it's marble or this or that. So some people thought Krishna, they thought, oh, he's a human being. Although one thing I should mention, Krishna was so incredibly good looking. He was like, you know, I mean, far beyond any movie star. That sometimes even when the demons came to attack Krishna, they would like stop for a moment and they would say, oh my God, he's good looking. I mean, Krishna was so, like, what do they say, drop dead gorgeous? Krishna was so... Krishna was just like literally, like inconceivably handsome. Just you can't imagine. And that's one point that's made over and over again in the Bhagavatam, that the women were just like, you know, they were just going daffy over Krishna. You know, they're going loopy when they saw Krishna, because like Krishna would come into Indraprastha, or he'd come into Hastinapur or Dwarka, and the women were just like, you know, they were just like, they could hardly control themselves because he was just so attractive. And even the men admired him. He was just so... Krishna, he's so attractive. Krishna is so attractive. He's infinitely strong. He knows everything. He's the kindest. If you think about Krishna, he has all the good qualities infinitely. He's a perfect person. Every other day, I sometimes see little bits of movies because I'm writing a novel, trying to reach more people. And they had some movie, it was a sci-fi movie. I forgot who was in it, but... Oh, yeah, it was one of those Bruce Willis movies, the guy that keeps saving Earth, like, over and over again, every summer.
The Fifth Element? Kind of
hard.
What?
The Fifth Element?
Yeah, Fifth Element. But it was so bad. Because, so they had this lady, who's like this beautiful girl who's kind of supposed to be like the perfect creation of the universe and the highest being in the universe. And then she's been kind of like... injured or you know the asuras kind of did something to her, so she's coming back to her consciousness, and she hasn't eaten, I don't know, like maybe like in a few trillion years or something. And so then you just see her like an animal, like, eating like this like, you know, chicken and, you know, turkey, and it was like I just shut it up. It's like, oh my God, it was so gross. Like here, you know, the supreme being, this higher being who will save the universe, and she's just like a barbarian, just like, you know, eating all this meat. It's like unbelievably ridiculous. So Krishna is not like that. I mean, Krishna is not an airhead supreme being, like Hollywood sometimes conceives of. Krishna, I mean, if you look everywhere, read all world literature, read every sacred book of every religion, go anywhere you like, you will not find anyone like Krishna. There's no one like Krishna. You know, you can look high and low, here and there. You will not find anyone like Krishna, who's infinitely beautiful, strong, intelligent, charming. There's just no one like Krishna. He's, as they say in Latin, sui generis, which means in his own category. Krishna's unique. There's no one equal to Krishna. There's no one greater than Krishna. Actually, Arjuna says that in chapter 11 after he sees the universal form. No one is equal to you. No one is greater than you. Natvat samo. You have no equal. Nabhyari kastya drishyate. And we never see anyone greater than you. So that's Krishna. So, how's that?
Great. Thank you very much. Any more questions? No.
Well, nice talking to you guys.
Yep. Well, in our school here, we normally give a quiz based on the class. So we'll get a quiz next week.
No, you it's so nice. See all you know, young, intelligent people learning about Krishna coming to the Sunday school. It's great. You're the best young people. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Pleasure.
Thank you. I told them that you had a PhD, and some of them have that desire.
Oh.
So they got to meet someone like you now.
Good, good. Yeah, we can do it. So my cane.